Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. One of the major promises Donald Trump made in his successful run for president was a significant change in our relationship with China in light of China's rise to the top of the global economy. Some of Trump's rhetoric has softened since he took office and since his meetings with top-level Chinese leaders.
But the fact remains that China has or is displacing the United States in many economic measurements. And that could spell danger, according to one ancient Greek historian, well, or at least a modern-day analyst who evaluates the U.S.-China relationship through a centuries-old lens.
Graham Allison is director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University and author of the new book, Destined for War, Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? And he joins us on the line from NPR headquarters in Washington. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think as we start this conversation, it would probably help if you give us a quick primer on who Thucydides was and what he was addressing in his observations, since obviously it was not the United States and China that he was writing about.
Absolutely. So Thucydides is multisyllabic, and it's certainly a mouthful. But Americans should learn who this person was and why his insights were important. Thucydides was the father of history. So he was the creator of the discipline of what we think of as history that tries to write down the facts about what actually happened so that we can read about what our predecessors did and not have to make the same mistakes. And he wrote about the two great city-states in classical Greece 2,500 years ago. And he wrote famously this line, "It was the rise of Athens and the fear that this instilled in Sparta that made war inevitable." So Thucydides' trap is the dangerous dynamic that occurs when a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power. And that, I believe, is the best lens available for helping us understand what's happening in the relationship between China and the U.S. today.
And I think you also make the key point that Thucydides was not just the father of history, but he was really the father of historical analysis, right?
Absolutely, and of historical analysis in order to try to think about the causes. As he says about this line, rise versus fall, he says, you know, lots of people say, well, there was this dispute and there was that dispute and there was a problem with Coursera. And he tells what people were saying at the time. But he says, I'm going to help you analytically go to the heart of the matter. The underlying dynamic is this Thucydidean dynamic. When you have a rising power threatening to displace a ruling power, you get normal behavior of both that allows events and actions by third parties that would otherwise be inconsequential or easily managed to trigger a set of actions and reactions that results in a war neither party would want. So in the case of Athens and Sparta, neither Athens nor Sparta wanted a war with each other. Indeed, Pericles, the great leader of Athens, had negotiated with his counterpart in Sparta the 30-year peace, and they were about 15 years into this peace. And then it came to be a struggle between two other parties, one of whom was an ally of Sparta, Corinth, and another party who was unaligned, Coursera. That spat ended up cascading into what became the war between Athens and Sparta. So Thucydides reminds us that when you have a rising power threatening to displace a ruling power, that substructural stress creates great danger for the two parties.
And of course, Thucydides studied Athens and Sparta, and you are writing about America and China, but there are many other cases of the Thucydidean trap that you write about, in fact, that you are studying in this case file you're compiling at Harvard, right?
Absolutely. So basically, the storyline is as old as recorded history itself, Athens and Sparta. But every century thereafter, we've seen examples. In the book, I look at the last 500 years. I find 16 cases in which a rising power threatened to displace a ruling power. 12 of them ended in war. Think about how we got into World War I 100 years ago today. But 4 of them, war was averted. So I say, and I think when you read it in context, Thucydides' claim about inevitable was really hyperbole. This was exaggeration for the purpose of emphasis. He only meant very likely. But as I also say in the book, business as usual in the case of China and the U.S. will likely produce history as usual. And in this case, a war between the U.S. and China would be catastrophic.
You know, a lot of the rhetoric about U.S.-China relations revolves around the idea that, China is going to overtake the United States in terms of its economic power. But you write, in fact, one of the key points you write is that by many measures, China has already overtaken the United States. Can you give us a sense for how the pace of growth in China compares to the United States and, in other parts of the world as well?
Well, a very good question. My tutor on this subject was Lee Kuan Yew, the fellow who founded and built Singapore, took a rock that was as poor than, you know, the Philippines, and before he was done, had a megapolis that is a richer, higher per capita income than the U.S. today. So he kept pointing out to me, you know, you Americans are simply not going to get it because you can't believe that there could be another power as big and strong as you are. But look at the facts. So I've been looking at the facts carefully. And I think I have, for those who haven't been looking as carefully as they should, a pretty good summary of this in the chapter of the book called The Rise of China. Never has a country risen so far, so fast, on so many different dimensions. A country that didn't even appear on any of the international league tables in 1980. In 2014, the big takeaway at the IMF World Bank meeting was China is now number one, the largest economy in the world, measured by what the IMF and CIA both agree is the best yardstick for comparing national economies, namely purchasing power parity. So in arena after arena, China has not only rivaled us, but already eclipsed us. And most Americans simply don't get it. As I quote in the book, the former Czech president, Václav Havel, who was a poet, that had great ways of putting things. He said, things have happened so fast, we haven't yet had time even to be astonished.
How much of the inevitability of the situation arises simply from the fact that China has so many more people and, such a larger, you know, appetite than the United States?
Well, good point. I mean, I think you just have to do the numbers. So if Chinese were only one-fourth as productive as Americans, then China and the U.S. would have equal-size economies because they got four times as many people. So is there some reason why they can only be one-quarter as productive as Americans? These are pretty smart guys. How about if they were half as productive as Americans? Well, then they're going to have an economy twice as big as the U.S. It's not comfortable for Americans, and especially for red-blooded Americans, or even worse, people like me, red-necked Americans, who, you know, we know that America means, USA means number one. We're destined to be number one somewhere. I say that I've been asking, maybe some radio listener will figure out the source. But I'm sure somewhere it is written, either in the Bible or in the Constitution or somewhere, that USA means number one. So the idea that there's a country bigger and stronger than we are, very uncomfortable for all Americans. But I think if you haven't yet seen China in your face or in your space, either you haven't been looking or you should just wait.
Well, and I think you make the point, you know, the appeal for many in Donald Trump's Make America Great slogan is this idea of the U.S. as number one. But the point could also be made that it's really not so different than the prevailing attitude in China.
Well, that's true. I mean, in part, both President Trump and his counterpart in China, Xi Jinping, are expressions of this Thucydidean dynamic, and Thucydides would understand it, you know, completely. Basically, for the ruling power, the idea that there's this upstart that's getting into my face, that's taking my position, that's taking some of my market, that's becoming a more important relations with one of my partners, all of this is unacceptable. And what President Trump expressed in the campaign, and lots of people found that they connected to, was the notion that, wait a minute, America is the greatest, and America needs to be the greatest, and we are being displaced by somebody, and if they're displacing us, there's something profoundly wrong with that. Interestingly, Xi Jinping, 4 years before Donald Trump picked up made his banner, Make America Great Again, Xi Jinping had already announced his banner. And his banner, when he became president, colloquially put, was to make China great again. They called it in Chinese the great rejuvenation of the great Chinese people. So in that sense, these two are significantly analogous.
Well, so as you look back through the case file, is it possible to have this displacement, the rise in power for one major player, without resulting in fear from the other?
Well, not without fear, not without all sorts of misunderstandings. I mean, what Thucydides helps us see is that as the rising power is rising, it says, I'm bigger, I'm stronger, my interests deserve more weight. The current arrangements which were made before I even got here or when I was weak don't take account of my interests. I deserve more say. I deserve more sway. All that's very natural. I mean, think of any upstart relative to an incumbent. And the ruling power, the incumbent, says, wait a minute. The way things are the way things should be. The way things are have actually provided the environment in which you've had the opportunity to grow up. So you should be appreciative of what we've done in providing the order that's allowed you to grow. But in general, the rising power is not grateful and wants more. And in general, the ruling power feels threatened and fearful. In those conditions, trust between the parties falls to zero. So anything either one does looks suspicious to the other. The misunderstandings are magnified. So you try to do something even helpful, I think he has a an ulterior motive. And I'm doing something defensive because I'm trying to protect myself. And you say, oh, no, that's not defensive. This is threatening me. So you get this exacerbation of these misunderstandings. And then finally, we both become more and more vulnerable to the actions of third parties. In this case, if we look at the U.S. and China today, somebody like Kim Jong-un, who otherwise should not even be a player in this game, but he can do things all by himself that end up having an impact on both the U.S. and China, and indeed that may impact both the U.S. and China, setting off a set of actions and reactions that could even lead us to war with each other, which neither of us want. And it makes no sense, but Athens and Sparta didn't want to go to war with each other. Germany and Britain didn't want to go to war with each other. But in one case, Corsera managed to get entangled with Corinth, as I say. In the other case, the assassination of an archduke in Sarajevo by Serbian terrorists, which otherwise nobody would have, we've hardly noticed that it would have mattered, became the spark that produced the fire that burned down the whole House of Europe.
Well, so what have you learned about the cases in which war did not break out in the Thucydides trap that might guide how we approach this evolving dynamic between the U.S. and China?
Two cases that are very instructive are, first, the rise of the U.S. to rival and then ultimately eclipse Britain at the beginning of the 20th century. That's when we came to a position of predominance in the Western Hemisphere and then ultimately in the world. And similarly, the Cold War, where the surge of the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s was met by the development of the most imaginative strategy in the whole set that I've seen, a strategy for competition and conflict along every dimension and by every means except bombs and bullets. So that was called Cold War. So in both of these cases, you had a combination of imagination. You had elements of a strategy that seemed inconceivable before people thought of it and began to implement it. And you had also a willingness to adapt and adjust and even compromise or even accommodate, at least for a long time, in ways that the recent American policy and especially American impatience and insistence on solving every problem immediately has just seems almost disconnected from.
It's interesting to be in 2017 and evaluating the Cold War as a success story. Didn't always seem like it would have ended up being the case.
Well, absolutely it didn't. I mean, we should remember how dangerous the path that we've come down was in the case of the Cold War. But we should also notice that a very, very demanding strategy that had serious ideas and serious stretch ideas, economically, politically, and in military and security terms, was followed for four decades by both Republican and American presidents and to the point of victory. So it is not impossible for the U.S. to be serious, to have a serious strategy, and to sustain it.
Well, and so as you look at the nascent months of the Trump administration, what would you say, how do you evaluate the path that we seem to be on at this moment?
Well, I would say uncertain, so to be determined. I think on the one hand, it is genuinely frightening to have a president who is basically a novice in this domain. This is not to say anything negative about him per se, simply to notice that he's not been in this business before. He's not been a student of international relations or American foreign policy or national security or indeed of history. So he's in a very, very fast learning mode. And that's dangerous because there will be crises, like the crisis that's brewing right now on the Korean Peninsula, in which just going with your first instincts as a citizen or as a businessman or a reality TV star is not the wisest course. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, he's picked an extraordinary group of national security advisors. His national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, is an A, absolutely an A. His Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, is an A, great proven scholar warrior. His Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is a very successful head of ExxonMobil and a thoughtful, you know, international person. So in the team around him and in their staff at the National Security Council staff, you've got, again, some very impressive, you know, very impressive team. So this group is working on the problems, and I think that it's way too soon to tell, but I'm a congenital optimist, and I'm hopeful.
How much of getting this right do you think lies in better understanding what China is trying to accomplish?
Well, I think that's essential. I think the first thing for getting it right is to be clear about American vital interests and distinguish those from things that are vivid just because they're bright, flashy objects, or that are vested, which are just things we've been doing for a long time. So how much does it matter to Americans who builds an island in the South China Sea or who owns an island in the South China Sea? These are important issues. They're not unimportant. Our relationship with the Philippines or Vietnam is not unimportant, but it is not vital for the U.S. So just the fact that we've been doing it for a long time, or just the fact that it seems flashy that what's happening in an island or a dispute does not mean it's vital for American survival and well-being. So I think that's the first, second, and third thing to keep in mind. But secondly, we should be very clear-eyed about what China wants. China wants to be great. China wants to be powerful. China wants to be the predominant power in Asia, the same way Teddy Roosevelt wanted to be the predominant power in the Western Hemisphere. That's very normal and natural for an emerging power and for a China that's as big as China and that has the history of China and that will be economically as strong as China. But it goes, you know, kind of head-to-head with Japan, which does not want to be dominated by China, with India, doesn't want to be dominated by China, by the other nations of the region, and by the Americans. We are an Asian power, and we're not leaving. We're proud, rightly, I believe, of the order, both the economic and the security order, that the U.S. built after World War II and that we've sustained for seven decades, which are the main reason there have been seven decades without great power war. And the main reason why Asia and the Asian countries have had the opportunity to enjoy the Asian miracle. So we're not about to walk away from this order, but how to adapt it, how to adjust, and how to persuade China of the benefits of finding a way to work together as opposed to insisting on having it entirely its way. I think that'll be the challenge going forward. Stay tuned.
Well, Graham Allison, it is a lot to think about. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Very interesting conversation, and I'll look forward to more.
Graham Allison was the founding dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He was also Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Clinton and the author of several books, the latest of which is called Destined for War: Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? He joined us on the line from NPR in Washington.